Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. This week, the staff of East County Magazine is on vacation. We'll be back soon with lots of breaking news, but for today, we hope you'll enjoy some of our favorite top newsmaker interviews and features as we present Best of East County Magazine's radio show, Where East County Matters. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice in Descanso. Broadcasting on the road today, we are at the offices of CSA San Diego right here in El Cajon, and my very special guest is Estela de los Rios, who is the Executive Director of CSA San Diego. Estela, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam. It's a pleasure to be on once again to address some of the issues here in East County, but also locally in San Diego region.
Now, Estela, CSA works on many interesting projects, but we're here today to talk about the important issue of human trafficking. Can you give us some figures on how big a problem human trafficking is, first of all, at a global and a national level?
Absolutely. Human trafficking threatens the safety of families, women, and children, and $150 billion globally is being profited by human trafficking. There's 850,000 gangs globally, and cartels are making $100 million off of this business. It's a commodity. Sex slaves are a commodity in this nation.
Those are really shocking figures, and we know certainly that it's a serious problem locally as well. We've seen these sweeps with the district attorney, Bonnie Dumanis, working to crack down on it in conjunction with other law enforcement agencies. But do you have some figures on just how serious the problem is right here in San Diego County in our border region?
Yes, and that's a very good point. Because of the proximity of our border, this is one of the hot spots. We are the top three cities, according to FBI. Wow. Here locally, we have 100,000 minors that have been prostituted. The average age is 12 years old. And just recently, we had a sweep here in East County at our local school.
And that's right here in San Diego County, folks. This is really horrifying. Estela, I know you've said that your organization is working to build on the momentum that these sweeps have started and help just sweep this away from our region. What are you doing to outreach to the schools and get the word out to parents, teachers, and students about how to avoid having kids right here in East County and San Diego become victims of these human traffickers?
Because of the huge problem that we have to educate, protect, and motivate. And part of our projects are going out to the schools, having forums. We've had two already, one at Lincoln High School, which we had a good turnout of 300 parents and students. We had another one in Lemon Grove. Actually, more people assisted, 400 parents and students. And this is the target population that we have to educate on this crucial issue, because there's predators out there that are just going around the schools and picking up these girls. And next thing you know, they're missing and they're in the sex slave trade.
So they're actually recruiting them right out of the schools. This isn't necessarily out of gangs or at the shopping mall or the streets. It's literally happening in the halls of the schools here in East County and San Diego.
Yes, and you brought up a good point, because they are at the schools, but we just recently found out that one of the hot spots, too, is Parkway Plaza. Surprisingly, these predators are at the malls. They are at the trolley station. There are places where our students are after school, but most importantly, during school, there's a lot of activity also happening.
So how do these predators select the targets, and what do they do? Are they just snatching them out of the mall, or are they grooming them in some fashion to sort of condition them to go along with these predators?
The most vulnerable are the ones that they prey on. And most vulnerable meaning lonely girls. Most of them are girls, unfortunately female. The lonely girls, the depressed girls, girls that are looking for attention. And we've heard over and over by survivors and by parents of survivors, the most important thing to show your child is love, because these females are looking for love. And if they find someone that gives them that attention, for example, a predator that says, "Oh, honey, I love you. You are beautiful." Sometimes, you know, a female just wants to feel wanted, feel like they're beautiful, and feel that they have some validation. And unfortunately, these predators know this. They go to the malls, they buy them gifts. That's another red flag. They buy them gifts. If you see your children coming home with gifts that you didn't give them money for, a new cell phone, a new dress, new shoes, new bags, you know, expensive gifts, something that you normally would not buy your child, please investigate where she got that gift.
So how does this work? Once they entice them with these expensive gifts and say, "I love you, honey," or "You're beautiful," what's the next step that happens?
Well, many a times it doesn't even have to happen at a school. It could be at a Starbucks. It could be at a party. They will put something in their drink. It could be a coffee. When they go to the bathroom, they come back and they're drowsy, or they drug them, and then they take them to a location. And many of these are homes. Many of these are houses where they just take them there, and unconsciously they are kidnapped, and the rest is history.
Wow, that's terribly frightening. So what are the things that parents, students, and teachers should know, other than what you've already mentioned, Estella? What are some of the warning signs that one can watch for?
One of the things that we do recommend for parents is be very vigilant. I know that cell phones is a very good communication tool, and a lot of parents don't watch or monitor what their child is doing on the phone or on the internet. You have to block the communication, and you have to monitor the communication. A lot of the red flags are when your child is spending a lot of time on the phone or on the computer or away from home at the mall, for example, just what we spoke about. And I just want to give another example. We had one cheerleader that was had practices, and for a long period of time, she had a boyfriend. No one knew who he was. He was an older gentleman. She would tell her friends, you know, "He's going to pick me up," and everything was fine. Until one day, she didn't come back to school. And this boyfriend was not a boyfriend. He was just a predator who took her and dropped her off at a local house. And they have him here in East County. They have him here in the San Diego region. And to this day, you know, she has been a victim of trafficking, and sometimes they are rescued. We have a very good network of law enforcement. We have a very good network of partners that work diligently to combat this type of human trafficking.
What would you say if somebody listening to this is a victim of human trafficking themselves? They fall into the sex trade. How can they get help and not be afraid that they might be prosecuted or get in trouble of some sort?
Fortunately, we have very many services that we offer. Again, collaboration with law enforcement, collaboration with shelters, collaboration with health services. We have a holistic approach to this issue. They can call 619-444-5700, and they can be assisted with any victim services that they like. We like to call them survivors. Not victims, but survivors. Survivors, because it takes courage to speak up. And it's very dangerous, very dangerous. But we know that there's a lot of survivors out there. And if you're one of them, please give us a call, 619-444-5700. We work very closely with law enforcement. They will protect, first and foremost, you. And then we can get you some shelter, some services, psychologically and physically as well.
Yeah, I understand that one thing that's really changed in recent years in California and San Diego is the way that these survivors or victims are treated. It used to be that they might be treated like criminals themselves, and now it's being understood that they were victims of these traffickers. Is that correct, Estella?
Yes, there's a lot of survivors that I work with, I collaborate with. Many of them have their own 501c3s now. I went with one to the United Nations. They are the voice. They are the advocates. They are preventing this from occurring to your child or to anyone, because that could be your child, it could be your sister, it could be your mother. It has no barriers. The youngest is 12 years old and the oldest is 64 that it has occurred to.
Wow. Are they also recruiting these young people online, over the internet?
Absolutely. We have the pornography that is on the internet. We have all these online sites, even Craigslist. Unfortunately, you know, you never know who is on that other side of the phone, the computer. And this is another thing, parents, you need to monitor anyone that's communicating with your child. You are the parent. You are the one that needs to know what is your child doing at all times and all hours.
Even Facebook. I mean, I hate to say it, but we've done investigations on a couple of missing teenager cases, and it was really easy to find. You put in the name, and there was a Facebook page that was pretty obviously a front for prostitution, with pictures of this young girl posing basically naked in sexual poses and things, and really disturbing to see something like that going on. Are there things that people in the community can do if you suspect human trafficking going on? If you see a site like that, what can you do?
Please, again, I can't emphasize how much it's important. It doesn't matter what you see. Please call 619-444-5700. One child said at one of our forums, "I wish my parent had taken my phone away."
Wow. So for parents who are worried about monitoring their teenager's action, this really is very serious stuff, and there's good reason for it, certainly if you have reason to believe that your child is going to fall victim to one of these predators. Estella, as far as CSA goes, what are your next steps here?
We are diligently working to address human trafficking. We've been working on it for 15 years. We have local projects, like I mentioned, workshops, educate, motivate, and protect. And we also work on a national scale, advocating for the laws to protect survivors and to prosecute predators, to prosecute other predators, even the ones that are online. There's not enough laws to protect our human trafficking victims.
If someone from a school, a teacher, a principal out there, a parent, is listening to this broadcast and they want you to bring your program to their school, what does it take to make that happen?
We can make that happen. Please give us a call, 619-444-5700. We encourage you. Please, it's necessary to protect our children, our families, and our community.
Very good. And if people want to get more information on this, what is the website that they can go to find out more about CSA or any other resources you may suggest for information about human trafficking in the San Diego area?
www.c4sa.org. Please, I encourage you, always, always look out for any signs of human trafficking. Thank you.
Stella, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the network for social justice, to speak out on this extremely important issue of human trafficking right here in San Diego and East County.
Thank you, and I'm very proud that you are that voice for East County.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. Pope Francis, on a flight to Rome, declared to reporters, "In September, God willing, I will canonize Junipero Serra in the United States." In other words, the Pope intends to make Junipero Serra a Roman Catholic saint. When Father Junipero Serra, with a battalion of Spanish soldiers, built a mission near Kumeyaay Bay in 1769, there were around 300,000 indigenous people living in California. Serra was the founder of 9 Roman Catholic missions from San Diego's Mission de Alcala to San Francisco. Serra's accomplishment is hailed as the origin story for California, filled with grand deeds. It is said that Serra performed a miracle by curing a nun in St. Louis of lupus. While beatification requires a miracle, the next step, canonization or sainthood, requires a second miracle. But Pope Francis, a fellow Jesuit, made an exception, calling Serra a holy man and a great evangelizer. Serra baptized nearly 6,000 Indians. It was for Serra's great evangelizing that Pope Francis points to as qualifying him as a saint. However, Junipero Serra is no saint to indigenous people. He viewed the indigenous tribes as heathens who desperately needed the gospel, but the indigenous people of California paid a high price for their conversion. The missions were built with Indian slave labor. Their ancient food supplies dwindled. Smallpox, measles, plagues, and other diseases spiked as they came together in these tight concentrations and their numbers plummeted. According to author and historian Robert Jackson, given a native population collapse in the Spanish Catholic missions of Alta California, any Indian person consigned to or born in a mission had been pretty much given a death sentence. The massive destruction of the original nations and peoples of California is the reason why there ought to be a mourning rather than a celebration associated with the ship San Salvador and the Spanish Catholic mission system. Stephen Newcomb, co-founder of the Indigenous Law Institute, wrote, "Pope Francis and the Vatican are going to celebrate the deadly and unsaintly Spanish Catholic mission system by bestowing sainthood on Junipero Serra. What does that say about a religion and a society when it pretends that a tradition of dehumanization and brutal domination is a tradition of virtue and saintliness? The same institute that brought us the Crusades, a Borgia Pope, and the Inquisition is now going to sanctify Serra's legacy." Father Manuel Tony Diaz, the administrator of the San Gabriel mission founded in 1771 by Serra, said his joyous reaction to the announcement of the Padre's canonization was tempered by the knowledge that some of his own parishioners look upon Serra as a reminder of a lost or frayed tribal history. At the time when Juan Cabrillo sailed into Kumeyaay Bay, the Kumeyaay Nation had a complex way of living off the land, migrating from the coast to the foothills every year to follow the food supply, cultivating and harvesting staples and weaving elaborate baskets to store and carry their goods. They manipulated the chaparral with fire to produce more food to pick and animals to hunt. Cattle ranching and sheep grazing by the Europeans led to the collapse of the traditional Kumeyaay economy, aided by a later law banning the Indians from burning the landscape. Those who converted were forced to drop their old ways and eat, dress, and act like the Europeans. Public Broadcasting produced an alarming documentary on Serra and the mission system. They had this to say. Despite the frequent conflicts between military and religious authority for Alta California's Indians, the missions and their Franciscan administrators were part and parcel of an enormous destructive colonization process. The Spanish, largely through disease, were responsible for a population decline from about 300,000 Indians in 1769 to about 200,000 by 1821. The strenuous work regime and high population density within the missions themselves also caused high death rates among the mission Indians. By law, all baptized Indians subjected themselves completely to the authority of the Franciscans. They could be whipped, shackled, or imprisoned for disobedience and hunted down if they fled the mission grounds. Indian recruits, who were often forced to convert nearly at gunpoint, could be expected to survive mission life for only about 10 years. As one friar noted, "The Indians live well free, but as soon as we reduce them to a Christian and community life, they fatten, sicken, and die." In Junipero Serra's defense, Gregory Orfaleo, who wrote a biography of Serra, said, "When the Kumeyaay sacked the San Diego mission in 1775, killing three Spaniards, the viceroy captured about a dozen Indians and called for their execution. But Serra called for the prisoners' release and pleaded their case to the viceroy in a letter in which he wrote, 'As to the killers, let them live so that he can be saved, for that is the purpose of our coming here and its sole justification.'" In doing so, Orfalea says Serra modeled his life on the gospel of love, not a desire for land or gold. And in this way, he was different from Columbus, who enslaved and tortured Caribbean natives in his quest for precious metals. Orfalea said Pope Francis' decision was no surprise. A Jesuit who took the name after the saint and founder of the Franciscan order, Francis does not believe in Catholicism confined to the ivory tower. Serra was a kindred spirit who abandoned a high-profile academic post to take on the dangerous, austere life of a missionary. Ruben Mendoza, coordinator of California Mission Archaeology at Cal State Monterey Bay, says the canonization is long overdue. I've always felt the canonization process was stymied through misinformation and politicalization and laying blame and onus on one individual who was actually in constant conflict with the governors and military commanders in New Spain over how they were treating the Indians. He and others said Serra fought efforts to enslave the Indians, and whippings were not limited to natives, but a common method of discipline in the Spanish Empire. Steve Newcomb concludes, the fact remains that the Juan Cabrillo ship San Salvador was built with the spent lives of Indians and crushing Indian slave labor. The 21 Spanish Catholic missions were also built with Indian slave labor and resulted in a genocidal-level population collapse among the native nations of the geographical area known as California. Ron Andrade, executive director of the Los Santos City and County Native American Indian Commission, compared Junipero Serra to the Spanish conquistadors who subjugated South America. Andrade, a Luiseno Indian from the La Jolla Band of Kumeyaay, said Serra decimated the Indian population. Everywhere they put a mission, the majority of Indians are gone, Andrade said, and Serra knew what they were doing. They were taking the land, taking the crops. He knew the soldiers were raping women, and he turned his head. Many tribes, including the Luiseno, the Juaneño, and the Gabrielino, survived the mission era through partial integration with each other and Spanish culture, but others fled inland or lost their culture completely, Andrade said. The choice of Serra for canonization is especially unfortunate given the Catholic Church has been making its first attempts at reconciliation with some of California's indigenous people who experienced devastating losses due to the colonial system Serra ushered in. On December 22, 2012, Bishop Richard Garcia of the Monterey Diocese offered the Ama Mutsin tribal band apologies from the church. He invited people to a massive reconciliation between the church and tribal members at Mission San Juan Bautista. In other former missions, tribal communities have sought reconciliation for the trauma their ancestors experienced, wounds that often remain open today. The selection of Junipero Serra as a saint seems antithetical to the current emphasis on and need for reconciliation.
As Californians make their Memorial Day weekend and summer vacation plans, Cal Fire and federal fire agencies want to ensure that vacationers obtain necessary campfire permits and learn how to have a campfire safely. The California Wildfire Coordination Group, or CWCG, has unveiled a new fire prevention website, preventwildfireca.org, which for the first time offers an online campfire permit section. Cal Fire Director and Chief Ken Pilmlott says, "The new online system makes it easier for Californians to get a permit while still taking the time to learn how to have a campfire safely." He adds, "It is critical that a responsible adult be in attendance at your campfire at all times and that it is completely extinguished before you leave to avoid sparking a wildfire. One less spark means one less wildfire." Fire officials from the CWCG, an interagency wildfire group comprised of local, state, and federal fire agencies, including Cal Fire, spent months creating the new system, which includes a short video and test prior to issuing the permit. While permits are still available at any Cal Fire, U.S. Forest Service, or BLM station or office, the online option is a quick and easy way to obtain a permit before beginning any trip in California. All a person needs is a computer with internet access and a printer. After watching a brief video on proper campfire techniques, the applicant will take a short quiz about the video and then receive their printable permit for free. Cal Fire reminds everyone that fire safety plays an important role outdoors, especially when it comes to campfires and outdoor cooking. Many unattended and improperly extinguished campfires have resulted in wildfires. With California in a severe drought and extremely dry conditions, not taking the time to ensure you have completely extinguished your campfire could result in a devastating wildfire. Campfires can also be extremely dangerous for children, so they should never be allowed to play around them or outdoor cooking appliances. Devastating burn injuries are all too common when these safety rules are not followed. Just a little forethought could protect you and your family. Here are some simple tips to ensure a safe campfire. Obtain a campfire permit and make sure there are not fire restrictions in the area. Use only approved and established campgrounds and campfire rings. Locate the campfire a safe distance away from tents, trees, or buildings. Clear the area around your campfire down to soil 5 feet from the fire's edge. Never let children use or play with lighter fluid or have them start a campfire. Completely extinguish campfires before leaving or going to bed. To obtain an online campfire permit or to learn more fire prevention tips on the One Less Spark, One Less Wildfire campaign, visit www.preventwildfireca.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Berenner.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. The East County Magazine show airs Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
You're listening to East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Leon Thompson. Today we're on the road in Julian, California, a historic gold rush town in the mountains of East County, San Diego.
Now, back in 1870, the town was founded by Drury Bailey and his cousin, Mike Julian. The two cousins were Confederate soldiers during the Civil War, both taken prisoner by the Yankees. After they got out and the war ended, they found their homeland had been laid waste by General Sherman's march to the sea, so they and other family members decided to head west. But Drury missed the boat to Panama, so he went overland instead. He did some hard rock mining in Montana. But then he ran out of money, so he flagged down a wagon train, and by a fortunate stroke of fate, he found that his brother was the driver. Drury founded the town of Julian in 1870 and named it after his cousin, Michael Julian. Traumatized by the war, Drury wanted to help others start new lives, so he gave away plots of land to anyone who agreed to build a home right away, as well as giving plots away for a school, a church, a jail, a town hall, and a chamber of commerce. Now, it wasn't hard to convince people to move to this remote mountain town. Since that same year, Julian resident Fred Coleman reportedly paused to give his mule some water and discovered gold in what is now known as Coleman Creek, and the Julian Gold Rush was on.
Today, we've brought along our team of interns to tell you about the hidden treasures in this town of Julian, California, where you can relive the Gold Rush days nearly a century and a half ago.
Hello, this is Trevor Hill, and I'm here with historian David Lewis. Thank you for being here, David.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So I'm just going to ask you a few questions about Julian. First, I wanted to know, who were the people who founded the town?
Basically, Drury Bailey and Mike Julian were the only people who were really involved in the town. Drury had homesteaded all this land, and then in 1870, when the major hard rock mines were discovered, that's when he hired a surveyor to lay out the town. So that's when I say it started, was February of 1870.
Who was Fred Coleman?
Fred Coleman is a black man that was in the area way before Julian was founded. We have him on San Diego County tax rolls in 1863, which is kind of interesting. That's when two the major battles of the Civil War took place. So it's right in the middle of the Civil War. So what's Fred doing here at that time period is interesting by itself. We don't have any answers to that. We probably never will. But Fred, he was apparently, according to local lore, had cattle here. He was friendly with the local Indians. We know that because he eventually married an Indian woman, Maria Jesus Anejo. Fred was apparently out looking after his cattle and stopped to water his horse in a creek. Again, this is local lore. They really expand on it sometimes, telling him that he took his frying pan out of his saddle bags and all this, but we don't know any of this. We just know that Fred was the guy that discovered the gold. Apparently, Fred couldn't keep a secret. because pretty quick there were a bunch of people panning in that creek. And that was placer gold, the can you do pan for in water in a creek. But it didn't last very long. And so then they started working their way up the creek to find the source of the gold. And that's when they found it in these hills north of town.
And how did the discovery of that gold change Julian?
Well, Julian didn't even exist when that gold was discovered. So that was like the launch point for everything that happened around here. When word got back that they had found successful mine workings up here, and the first loads of ore ended up downtown on display and taken up to San Francisco for milling and assaying, that launched Julian.
Wow. Do you have any colorful stories that you've heard about the gold rush or just Julian in general?
There's lots of colorful stories, but I'm the historian for the cemetery too, and people always ask me who the most interesting person from Julian that's buried in that cemetery. And that's Drury Bailey, the man that founded this town. Because when he founded this town, he went and he fought in the Civil War right after he got out of high school. Terrible deal. The family lost all of their land back there, and they end up here. And Drury homesteads all this land, and then, like I say, gets that surveyor. Drury's 26 years old when he did this. I find that pretty amazing because I was still looking for some gas for my car and hoping for a date when I was 26 years old. And this man starts a town. He made a pretty good reputation for himself as being a generous person, but he also had a lot of foresight.
Interesting. Can you tell us about this building that we're in right now, the Pioneer History Museum?
This building started out life. It was built by Joseph Treschel, who was a blacksmith. And he ran it for a few years. This was in the 1890s. And then he sold it, or leased it, I'm not sure which, to Peter Meyerhofer, who brewed beer here. And then it went back to another blacksmith, Christian Grosskopf, who blacksmithed here. And that was the last thing that I know that happened in here. It fell to ruin. All that was left are these rock walls in here. Wow. And in 1952, the Women's Club took it upon themselves to get some county money and some volunteers, and they rebuilt what you see here.
Wow.
So there's been a little expansion out the front, and we're doing a little expansion out the south end right now. But
so these are the original stone walls that we're seeing around
those us? Those right there, yes. And
wow.
Those were probably mined right here on site. That's Julian Schist, S-C-H-I-S-T, just to clarify that. Anyway, that is what is unique to this Julian area, and it's the quartz within that schist where the gold is found. So when they flattened this area out, they were cutting that stuff off, and it comes off in slabs because it's sedimentary,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard, mm-hmm. and then it's stackable. That's how these walls came about, was right from what was here.
Wow.
How often can you do that anymore?
Do you have any favorite exhibits here at the museum?
Well, probably my favorite is the Bailey exhibit because I almost feel like family. I know as much or probably more than a lot of the family does about them because that's been my focus. It has a few personal things in there, but my favorite one is that pick that's exhibited in there. It's not necessarily a pick that you would use for mining ore. It's for picking out samples. And he was injured in the mine in 1899, disappeared from the logbook for a while on the payroll.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came back, he had fashioned that pick as a cane also.
Wow.
So it's a little short, you might know. And
hit a hunch, maybe.
not Drury. Drury. This is the giant founder of the town is 5'3" tall. So I've got a little picture that I did once. I photoshopped him in, me and my documentation, right? I photoshopped him in next to me and put a ruler between us just to show the difference of what we look like.
Wow. Thank you so much for answering my questions.
You're very welcome.
Anyone can come here and talk to David on Sundays you're here?
I'm usually here off and on.
Okay.
Lately, I've been able to get Drury's grandson, Richard Bailey. Anybody that comes up here can talk to the grandson of the founder of the town.
I have one more question. When did the mine close, the Julian mines?
All in varying stages. There was no real just shutdown. people kept piddling around. Mm-hmm. They're still out there piddling around.
Wow, really?
Yeah, you know, especially when times get hard. People mm-hmm. are out there trying to get lucky. But say from 1900, they were pretty much done. But then my grandfather's draft record shows he was a hoist operator at the Golden Chariot, and that would have been about 1918. Now we mine tourists.
Well, okay. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Up next, we're going to have Jaden Jimenez tell us about what he found most interesting about the museum here.
While I was looking through the museum, one of the more interesting things that I found was a railroad spring. It was on a railroad cart. And what they did is they got the spring and put it in the Victorian Town Hall here in Julian. And basically, it was for the dance floor. So when there was large groups of people, they would dance and it would actually really add a springy effect. So I thought that was pretty interesting. One of the only spring floors left is actually in the Hotel del Coronado.
Wow, that's so interesting. Thank you, Dayton.
What do you think, guys? How would you like to go try your hand at some gold mining?
I'm feeling lucky.
All right, let's go.
This is Devon Marshall, and we're here at the Eagle Mine in Julian, which is open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to mid to late afternoon or so if you want to tour the mine or try your hand at penny for gold. Now I'm going to be talking to Mr. Craig Nelson, whose family owns and operates the mines, and with Kim Gordon, one of our guys today.
My grandpa, he ran this from about the late 60s all the way till he passed away. Then my dad took over, and then he passed away about 10 years ago. And then me and my brothers that took over, and we're really blessed to have a grandpa that decided not to dig the gold out of the mountain because that's a lot harder of a job. Taking you folks through that mountain and teaching the history is a lot fun.
So then the real gold is the tourism.
Well, the education.
Okay.
I'll tell you, because the tourists that come to Julian, California, and I always, I'll tell you, the local town museum down there, which is Mr. Lewis, right. And those folks, and we just did Kim did a nice seminar down here at the library the other night, and you know, a lot of the kids don't realize what it takes to gold mine back in the 1870s and how they just barely made a living with this type of method. And they all want keyboards and phones and, you know, the technology of today. They don't pick up the pick and shovel and mm-hmm. you know, do 8, 10, 12-hour shifts under hard rock mining. And that's what we want to show you is it's hard to get a guy to do that kind of work anymore.
So Steven, one of our interns, is here, and he's going to try his hand at some of the panning for gold. Can you come over and give him a couple pointers on how to do this?
You want the sand to go over the rigid. That's why they make the tools. It's black to keep the metals separated. You can see the colors.
Uh-huh.
So like you said, you scrape to the bottom. Now what I do, once you get it in a pan, I settle it, shake it. Because then you get control of the sand by settling the gold to the bottom of the pan. Then when you get to the gold to the bottom of the pan, you simply let the pan and the water do the work for you because that's what it's made to do. But you know what the first gold pan used to be back in the 1800s? The gold horn. We got a gold horn in there, so what they did is cut the end of the horns off. It's a U-shape, right? You scrape it down into the stream, and you rock it back and forth. The gold being heavy stays in the metal. Unfortunately, I'm not going to go cut some horn off of a steer or something like that and get the end of the horn. Take the pan, and then once you settle the gold and you're happy with it, then you just let the water in the pan wash the sand out because the gold's heavier and it goes to the bottom.
Okay, so we have Steven over here who's been trying his hand at it. Steven,
what's his yield?
Come tell us how it's going.
It's been going good. I found myself a lot of gold, and the techniques by Kim,
our favorite tour guide, one of our friends mm-hmm. and family.
It actually works.
Yeah, ooh, look
now,
at all that.
What you want to do is concentrate. We want to see what you got as a collector. Get it all to the end of the pan, concentrate it by tapping it. Keep water in the pan. And then it separates, just like up at the mill. The sand will always go first, and the gold, being the heaviest, will drag out of the back with the black, that's the iron, separates by the metal like the mill up there. And you tap it, and you start rolling it. And the gold being heavier, we're going to chase the gold tail, as they call it. And look at how it comes and drags out the back. So now doesn't that look
yeah.
prettier? The
now
way that
talking.
You could look at it like that.
Eureka!
Eureka! You know, you're both trying. So that's what you get. That's about $10, $12 worth of a gold tail right there. Now we're going to start at the Eagle Adit, because instead of an entrance to gold mine, they call them adits, A-D-I-T. It's a cluster of puzzles.
What can we expect when we go down to do the mine tour?
Well, what we're going to expect is we're going to go over to the entrance, and we're going to learn how do you know where to start your tunnel? Because they couldn't pan for gold with the streams drying up. So we're going to go over the mountain. We're going to look at the way that the layers and the mountain structured. And we're going to show you how they go into the mountain and abstract the gold-bearing ore, the quartz, out of the mountain. You just learned how to get the gold out of the quartz. by the California 5 stand mill. Now remember, that machine would operate right on that foundation right there, and we moved it up there when my grandpa made this a tour business. That way you had two-stage tour area right there. And once you move 22 tons, you don't move it back as you go. So we're going to show you how they go through that mountain and pull out the gold-bearing ore, and you already seen how to process it. So let's go see how we can get that quartz, the gold-bearing ore, out of the mountain.
Okay, we can send our interns down into the mine. You guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
We're going to cover...
Bye.
Yeah. Well, it was nice knowing you. We'll see you in about 50 years of being abandoned on the mine.
This is Leon, and we're down in Julian, California, and our interns are back. How did it go on the mine shaft?
Oh, well, it was really great. We got to learn a lot of stuff, and it was really interesting, you know, learning the history. One of the coolest things that I thought that happened while we were in the mine is while we were in, you know, all the lights are on, you can see, you know, decently well, but he took us to this room where there was a candle, and he turned off all of the lights to light up the mine, and it was complete darkness. There's no light source coming in whatsoever. And so we lit the candle so we could see how, you know, the old miners used to see just such dim light. And they had to deal with this for 10 hours a day. And so, yeah.
My favorite part of the mine tour was seeing all the gadgets that the miners used back then. And one gadget in particular was the Widowmaker, which was a pneumatic drill. It was created to carve deeper into the cave. The pneumatic drill would drill into the rocks, and then they would put dynamite in the holes, and the dynamite would explode, causing a lot of dust to affect the lungs of the miners, causing them to have lung cancer. And that's why they call it the Widowmaker.
Well, my favorite part of the tour was we got to this point in the mine where there was a shaft that went straight down for 425 feet. And our tour guide showed us the bucket that they used to pull ore up from the mine, and it turns out that they also used it as an elevator. And there was this huge steam-powered machine that cranked the rope because it's such a long drop. You can't really have people trusted to hoist someone up that far. And there was a bell on the machine that was so loud, and it was to give signals. Different amounts of rings meant different things. And it was so loud, and it echoed throughout the entire mine, and I just thought it was really cool.
So what do you think? So how would you guys have liked to make your living as a hard rock miner?
I'll leave that to the old-timey miner people.
Tough work, huh? Well, I bet you guys have worked up an appetite.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, walking all over town, going down the mine. All right, well, let's go find something wonderful to eat. And there's no shortage of great places to eat up here in Julian.
Especially if you're looking for apple pie. Because Julian's goal these days is the tourists that come here to enjoy this wonderful town. Let's go eat!
This is Jaden Jimenez with East County Magazine, and I'm here with Charles Scott. He works at Candied Apples and here in Julian, so can you tell us a little bit about history about Candied Apples in Julian?
You bet, yes. My name's Charles. I'm the pastry chef and owner of the Candied Apple Pastry Company in Julian. We've been here for 11 years. Julian's kind of got a very interesting history with apples. It started with the gold miners who settled in this community in the late 1800s. They found that they could grow apples very easy here. In the early 1900s, they sent a bushel of apples to one of the world expos and won a gold medal. And that put Julian on the map for apples. Of course, supply and economics changed the world of apples up here a little bit. As Julian grew, some of the apple farms were turned into housing developments, wineries. And, of course, some of the apple growers retired. But there's still quite a lot of apples being grown up here, from a range of apple cider apples to you-pick apples to organic apples.
And apple pies.
And apple pie. Yeah. Yeah, the apple pie history actually goes back probably to the Farmer family. Bud Farmer was an apple grower up here, and his wife used to make apple pies. This is dating back probably 40 years. As they handed off the business, Liz Smothers from the Julian Pie Company and Anita Knowles from Mom's took that over and kept the apple pie business alive up here in Julian and have kept that name quite alive. Of course, the Julian Pie Company, that works very well. Our little bakery is a European bakery and bistro concept. Of course, being in Julian, you have to make apple pie, so we do make apple pie.
Yeah,
along with many other things like 12 kinds of breads. I have a 7-year-old sourdough starter started in the French way from a white wine yeast. We do pastries, desserts, wedding cakes, catering, full-service lunch menu, and, of course, French crepes.
Wow. How did you get started with this store?
With this store? Well, this store was a transition from 35 years of hard work. I started in the industry as a young boy doing dishes, got promoted to cooking because I said I didn't want to do dishes anymore. Worked my way through the industry, some fine hotels, did my formal training in New York at the International Pastry Arts Center. Ended up in Borrego Springs as the executive chef of a hotel there, and in there at La Casa del Zorro. And in the process of them closing down and selling out, this bakery was on the market, and I chose to buy it 8 years ago.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And it's been 8 years of quite the wild ride of producing delicious desserts, pastries, breads, wedding cakes, birthday cakes.
So can you tell us a little bit about the community here? I know earlier you're talking about how so many people come in.
Julian's, I mean, it's like I said, it's got a very diverse history. Today, Julian has really put itself on the map as a tourist community. Anybody who comes to San Diego, is part of the program is to see Julian, hear the history of Julian. I've met people from all parts of the world, the Far East, the Mideast, quite a few European travelers, Sweden, Germany, Italian, and, of course, America. I mean, I've met people from all over the world who come in the bakery here. It's very fun.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. Thank you for interviewing with us. This was great. We're going to enjoy this delicious lunch. Got a few sandwiches and crepes. A
couple of paninis and some crepes, you bet. Thank you for joining us.
Candied apples, we're looking forward to trying those.
For dessert. There we go. You got to save room for dessert. Life is uncertain. Save room for dessert.
Thank you.
So we'll be back soon with another edition of On the Road in East County. We're signing off from Julian, California. You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso.
But all I know is this feels right when we're under the stars tonight. These butterflies that I can't fight, so I'll just let them fly.
It's Leon Thompson, and I'm here with Raylene Nicole, a promising young musician from East County. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thank you. Yeah, so I grew up my whole life in East County, my whole 18 years of life. We've moved around a lot, but basically it's been the same two freeway exits the whole time. I went to elementary school, middle school, Boston Valley, and then Las Coches Creek, and then I went to high school, Granite Hills, and I just graduated.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, I first heard you at the Coyote Music Festival at Cuyamaca College. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was a really fun experience. That was the first music festival I've ever been a part of, and I had no idea that I was actually going to be in that. And one day, I was at Starbucks in Rancho San Diego. They have an open mic, so I was at the open mic. Then I happened to walk in to grab a Starbucks, and on the little bulletin board, they had like a little flyer saying, oh, musicians need it. I'm like, oh, that's me. I think it was a website when I looked on, and it was the music festival, and I'm like, that would be super cool. And they were having tryouts, so I went to the tryouts, and it was really intimidating because I walked in and I was still a senior in high school, so it's all these college kids in this big giant like performance hall, so, like with a stage and chairs, like theater looking. And so I was on the stage all by myself, me and my guitar, and then all these people in the seats. Part of their class was to judge the auditions, so they're all staring at me with papers, writing down notes. I had no idea what they were writing, and they're all looking up at me every now and then. So, and then I started playing, and one guy in the front, I remember, was like dancing to it, so I felt a lot better. I was like, okay, they like it, I'm not gonna die. So, and then I think they emailed me or called me back. They really liked your audition, we'd like to have you play at the festival. So my drummer Chemo and I just got together, practiced a little bit, came up with the set, and then we got to play, and it was so much fun. It was the coolest thing. It was, you know, it was a really nice day, so everyone was out there on blankets, like with picnics, and there was like tons of little booths around. And I think it was only their second or third annual. It was really new, so I'm sure it's going to even get bigger and bigger every year. So the students were running everything. That's a really cool class, you know, to teach kids to run a festival. That's something that you don't learn every day. There was a lot of other musicians and bands, and they had face painting. I got to get my face painted, and snow cones, and just little vendors and everything. So it was a really cool way to bring the whole college area community together.
Speaking of your music, how would you describe it?
I would describe my music as like a relaxing summer playlist, you know, when you're driving in the car. I have some upbeat songs that really get people going. I'm a typical teenage girl, so what else am I going to write about rather than, you know, the boy I have a crush on or something. So a lot of my songs are about that kind of feeling when you don't really know the person too well, but you can't wait to see what happens in the future. And that's, I think that's one of the funnest feelings ever, is like the feeling of possibility or who knows what's going to come. You know, I really like this guy and he, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but I like him. That's all I know. I have a couple other ones. They're also upbeat, and I'm trying to write more of these songs lately because it's how I feel, and it's more just about believing in yourself and not really listening to negative people or, you know, just positive sort of things and just about good feelings and sounds like rainbows, butterflies kind of thing. But, you know, I like that. So I like inspiring people to believe in themselves and go for what they really want to do rather than just be sad. But then on the other hand, I do have a couple sad songs that are extremely sad. So, but I think that's kind of what I like to make myself relatable, saying, you know, I understand how they feel, or like certain feelings that people don't like to touch on. But if the lyrics can understand how they're feeling, I think people like that and they'll relate to that and want to listen to that more. Yeah.
Can you do one of your songs for us?
Yes, I can. Is that the one?
Pouring Down.
Yes, I can.
All right. Thank you. Let's hear that.
So much more I haven't told you. There's so much more that you don't know. And everything's so new, but just trust me and I'll trust you. I've still got so much more of me to show. You've got those eyes that make me wonder. I wonder if you feel the way I do. Now I can't concentrate and it's your fault. I can't think straight, just tell me if your hands are shaking too. We're not too sure about anything, but honestly for me, that's okay. Kiss me in the rain out where it's pouring down, but I don't care, I'm giving up and I'm so scared to let you in. But all I know is this feels right when we're under the stars tonight. These butterflies that I can't fight, so I'll just let them fly. How come everything's so beautiful when I'm with you? The way we laugh on accident. I think I'm going under as we dance to the flash of thunder. We're so cool, we won't go inside just yet. We're not too sure about anything. But honestly, for me, that's okay. You kiss me in the rain out where it's pouring down, but I don't care, I'm giving up and I'm so scared to let you in. But all I know is this feels right when we're under the stars tonight. These butterflies that I can't fight, so I'll just let them fly.
thank you, Ray Lee.
You're welcome.
So what's coming up in your career? What is next for Ray Lee?
The next thing I really want to do is record a full album, 12-song album, mix of, you know, happy and sad ones. I still need a couple more songs before I do that, but I want to record that album, kind of tour around the country, kind of the poor musician's tour where I, you know, get in my own car and drive around, but hey, a tour is a tour. Just spread the music and see, you know, how far I can get it to go.
How did you get your musical training?
I have been taking piano lessons ever since I was 5 years old, and then I went all the way until high school started. So up till I was 15, so it was 10 years of piano lessons, and then I did, I think, like a week or two of vocal lessons when I was in middle school or something, and I didn't like it very much. And then even back then, I wasn't trying to sing. I just went to lessons just because, but I never really started singing until after my freshman year in high school, and that's when I started playing guitar as well, because my grandparents got me a guitar for Christmas during my freshman year, and then I didn't really do much with it. I learned a couple chords, and then that was that. And then after my freshman year of high school, during that summer, I think I put up my first YouTube video, and all my friends were like, oh my God. Now I look back on it and I'm like, oh, that was not very good at all. But back then, I mean, I got tons of praise for it. So I was like, okay, if I can hide on the computer screen and they like it, now I can go in person and maybe they'll like it too. So I started to play covers at local coffee shops and things like that in South Park and North Park, City Heights area. I started writing originals and playing those. And then that got me to go up and produce the EP and everything. And I never took any guitar lessons. It was really just, if you really, really want to learn something, you'll figure out a way to teach yourself. You will learn it. And especially today with the internet, it was so easy. I was on YouTube all the time. UltimateGuitar.com was a blessing, because once you learn how to read, because I used the book to teach myself to read chords and tab. And then once I could do that, I could get on Ultimate Guitar. And then each song had chords and tabs with it. And I was like, okay, well, now I can play the song. I would play it like 5 hours a day, like so much. And so I think I learned quickly. It kind of kickstarted a lot of time. I compacted it into one summer. But yeah, I never took lessons. I just used YouTube videos and online everything. So.
We're really glad that you did.
Thanks.
your voice is lovely and sweet.
Thank you.
And I like your chord progressions and changes and the range. It's just beautiful. So
thank
really
you so
appreciate
much.
You coming in
Thank
and
you.
Talking to us.
Thanks.
We've been speaking to Ray Lee Nicole. So how can people reach you if they want to hear some more of your music?
Well, I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all those social network things that everyone likes to go on. Just look up Ray Lee Nicole, which is R-A-E-L-E-E. That's Ray Lee. And then Nicole is N-I-K-O-L-E. And then I have a website, www.rayleenicole.com. www.rayleenicole.com.
Thank you so much, Ray Lee.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.